You're listening to the Urban Warfare Project podcast from the Modern War Institute at West Point. I'm John Spencer, Chair of Urban Warfare Studies at MWI and host of this podcast. Today's guest on the podcast is Colonel Kevin Black. Colonel Black is an armor officer who currently serves as the 71st Colonel of the 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment, Black Horse Regiment, the U.S. Army's premier unit that serves as the opposing force, OP4, for the National Training Center at Fort Irwin, California. Colonel Black, welcome to the show.
Hey, John, thanks for having me. As I sit here in my second year of command, it's actually my second assignment here in the regiment. Served all my field grade time in the regiment, so a great deal of time here spent out in the beautiful High Mojave. About 55 rotations through here, both as Blue 4 and Op 4, both as, you know, starting all the way from a PL all the way up to a battalion commander on the RTU side, and now as the Op 4 commander myself. The volume of reps that we get out here and wearing the Black Horse patch and fighting against it has given me some unique perspectives on what actually works and what doesn't work when the pressure and the chaos of combat start.
Absolutely. I can't wait to dig into some of that uniqueness to our, you know, premier combat training center. And I do know that, and in most of the Army listeners, if they don't know how much of a repeat offenders there are out there, whether it's the CG who was the commander of operations group, or you, the Black Horse, that comes up through, there is a little bit of a repeat offender, but they become some of the greatest trainers. And for yours, though, specifically, one of the global military, and as somebody who served, no offense, as Geronimo for in JRTC as the opposing force as a young soldier, some of the most proficient, not just in the planning, but also in operations, because you get so many reps and sets in a combat training center, learning from rotating units, but also adapting to, which we'll talk about, global changes in the character of warfare. You opened up with almost my first question. So how did you get there? Of course, and all of that rotations. For anybody who's not familiar, though, because this is a real, I don't think I've ever done this. I've had a lot of commanders of operations groups of all the combat training centers. And I've had a lot of other people's, but I think you're the first actual commander of the opposing force that I've had on the show. I could be wrong, but don't quote me on that. It's going 6 years long. For any listener who doesn't know, can you tell us a little bit about what is the Black Horse Regiment, its size, composition, even mission?
Yeah, no, not a problem, John. The 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment is the Army's premier professional opposing force, stationed here at Fort Irwin, California. And we currently, our force structure, we replicate an HCAB, a heavy combined arms brigade, and with combination of armor, mech infantry, and all of our enablers. We're sort of under strength compared to a US BCT, about 40% of their combat power. But we've also constructed some of the newest recon strike elements that we have out there with our Centaur squadron, dedicated UAS troops, really to replicate what the opposing force or any enemy that we would face on a battlefield would be. And that digs really into our core mission, which is providing that realistic, adaptive threat so that every brigade that comes through the NTC here is better prepared for large-scale combat operations. And because, like you mentioned before, of the changing character of warfare, you know, Black Horse, we've also had to fundamentally change the way we fight. We're now replicating exact effects, persistent recon strike, the dead zone that we will get into a little more, hopefully, that attrition, that sensor saturation that define the modern battlefield. The evolution of this is the catalyst that's going to drive the US BCT's lethality. And to be honest, we don't just play enemy. We evolve from our observed battlefields, you know, the Ukraine, Middle East, future combat that we have thought through. And then after every engagement, we conduct our own after action reviews and look at the data and make every rotation better for the next fight.
Yeah. As somebody who travels the world to, you know, embedding with multiple militaries, I'm of course an urban warfare training site connoisseur, and nobody has a full brigade dedicated not only to be operationally ready, but to be a fully dedicated opposing force. Most will just, you know, assign a unit tasked with that, but not live the life of an opposing force. That's their assignment.
That's correct. We're very unique in that. And that sort of grabs back to the essence of the National Training Center and General Dupree and General Story, who followed him, of setting it up. That was in their vision of having that professional op four from their observations of Israel and the wars that they went and personally gained those lessons from. Of how do I come out of Vietnam? How do I transform the army and get back to maneuver warfare? And the key to it all, the only reason that National Training Center exists is the Op 4. That's why people come out here.
Absolutely. And don't get me started on the Starry papers. Actually, that does remind me of you, which I'll call you a warrior scholar because you've published multiple pieces with the Modern War Institute. You mentioned two of them, actually, in the Dead Zone and the Empty Battlefield and the Reconnaissance Strike Battalion in the Mojave Desert. We're going to talk about them probably later in the episode, but that aspect of how prolific General Starry was, and like you said, the post even Yom Kippur studies that he wrote about and that need to change and evolve our fighting concept, whether that's air, land, battle, all those evolutions that we honestly don't have time to talk about, but I hear it in your words and it's hard not to venture into those lanes. Okay. For the episode, if I didn't mention it, the episode is almost a follow-on to all of my past episodes of attacking Rajesh, which I had the then Colonel Semmering, who was the commander of operations group, now General Semmering. I had him on talking about the Rajesh fight. I've been out there multiple times. I've done it at even Deir Alam for JRTC and JMRC and all these other locations. But I'm excited to talk to you about first as just in general and then get into Rajesh, the urban fight, and then I think open it back up again. As the Black Horse commander, what is your role in shaping the rotation, really, and to include even in those urban fights? Because I know there's not just Rajesh, but how is your role in that shaping of the fights?
A lot of my shaping's in sort of the structure, sort of the how Black Horse fights piece. And my background with the 55 rotations here, field grade time here in the Black Horse, rotational experience. And also I had a stint that I went over and worked with SAGU and some of the Ukraine mission. Sort of directly shapes how I command. And I've seen the old linear fights and then the new reality where unmitigated movement in the sort of transparent battlefield outside of cover, you know, it's consequential. And that's why sort of how we set the conditions where my job sort of comes in, set the conditions in our structure, the way we fight, standing up our Centaur squadron, which our recon strike capability, our manned, unmanned teaming before they ever even reach the city. And in the urban fight itself, this means the dead zone that's outside of Rajesh is now some of the real decisive terrain also. And our construct removes, you know, the echelons of leadership and sort of bureaucracy. So our sensor to shooters faster, intel flowing, and those are the pieces that I try to set with the structure before we even get into the battle of how we fight, the decision point tactics that enable our urban fights right there.
All right, that makes sense. So let's get into Rajesh. Now, every brigade, unless I'm mistaken, or every unit, rotating unit that comes to NTC fights this battle in some form. And I know it's evolved over time on trying to expand the number of hours or days when it occurs in the rotation. I fully get that. And I've done those past episodes, even while it was evolving, even from it, the city itself, which is one of the largest urban replicas. And we had talked even, you know, back in 2014, 15, trying to replicate portions of a mega city, all these evolutions of that city. I actually have my maps from dating myself when it wasn't called Rajesh. It was called either Tiford or, you know, it has evolved.
Medina Wasl, Medina Jabal.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But I recommend listeners to go back and listen to at least the Attacking Rajesh episode to kind of see how this one doves or not. I've also, before some of my current work, would go out and just watch actions on, because I do believe it's the biggest free play urban warfare exercise with an assigned defender and an assigned attacker that we have in the U.S. military. No other combat training center can replicate it. No other urban training facility, to be very honest, can replicate it, not with full armor, infantry, all the enablers capable because of NTC, like you said, its long history. But you have had the role as the commander, and I know it's a smaller than a brigade, usually, I think, assigned to defend, but you let me know, the role of defending the city every rotation. And could you, for just listeners, remind everyone what is Rajesh, some of the scale, the layout, and how has it evolved even in, like you said, 55 rotations? So surely it's evolved for you as well.
Yeah, it has. And just as a refresher, Rajesh is our largest urban center that we have here, about 706 structures in there to sort of replicate some of the high density urban terrain, multi-story buildings, narrow streets, sub-T or subterranean features mixed in with the desert terrain that funnels the approaches into the city. It's evolved here with better subterranean integration, modern sensor, our EW overlay. Again, the National Training Center is the only place that you can come and really face that full EW threat. Anything from SATCOM denial, GPS denial, anything you have, we have full ability to jam it. And that's the only place you can come to get that full experience in training. And it's the kind of complexity that the current battlefield will demonstrate. And most of the time it sits as one of the culminating events after days of rotation. Typically, brigades attack it to seize and clear after they isolate it. A lot of planning time is compressed, and execution once it starts is very high tempo coming into it. So again, Rajesh, you know, it's not Seoul in South Korea, but it's the best we have here in the high Mojave Desert that gets a brigade a rep at that urban training experience.
Zach, just describing it makes me miss watching it executed, let alone planned. Now, when you get the mission, I'm sure, because you get the, most people think that it's more scripted than it is, as in thinks that the Op 4 is more scripted than it actually is. It's actually free play. You do your own planning exercises. You assign your own unit the mission to defend the city, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And we have transitioned a lot from some of the scripting you talked about to more of that free play here lately, which is extremely good. It gets back to General Starry's core tenets here at the National Training Center. But like taking, you know, how do we defend that and why do we sort of win? Sort of like some of your points that you've made previously and some of your keys to urban warfare and your rules there. You know, hey, we love the defense. We're the strongest in the defense. And that's partially because our equipment deficiencies compared to, you know, U.S. Army is the best equipped in the world. The Op 4, we're probably some of the worst equipped for our mechanized equipment, but we make up for that with our troopers' skill and their training. And again, we're strongest in the defense, and we dominate that urban terrain here, defending, counterattacking the dense cities like Rajesh, using some of the core principles that make Black Horse lethal in the open desert. And some of our observations, you know, translate directly to the urban warfare, where the micro terrain, our mastery, flattened command and control, empowered junior leaders, and honestly, relentless simplicity, and doing reps and sets really amplify all those defender advantages that you've talked about in previously in a lot of your writing.
Yeah, I imagine your subordinate commanders and your soldiers all know. I mean, I know they know every inch of the box, let's say, but I'm sure you know every inch of Regis just like a defender would.
Oh yeah, exactly, and that's a key point. You know, one of the sort of myths of why Black Horse wins is, oh well, we know the terrain. Well, yeah, I hope every enemy that the U.S. Army fights knows the terrain, because if we know the terrain, it's a problem.
Yeah,
on that side. But we own that ground. We own the road through our numerous rotations that we've done, the reps, the urban settings. We have intimate knowledge of all the buildings, the alleys, the rooftops, the doors, the IV lines to get in and out, the subterranean routes where we can go from building to building, choke point to choke point. And we spend days pre-positioning our obstacles, strong points, minefields, integrating all of that together, and then integrating our mechanized force, our infantry fighting vehicles, our main battle tanks as mobile strong points to shape and then to counterattack in there. So yes, a lot of it comes from our knowledge of the terrain, but also just our sheer troopers' tenacity and their skill and their training level.
So one of the observations that even the commander of the operations group years ago when we did that podcast had is that most rotating units are so overcome by the planning cycle MDMP that they pretty much do the attack of Regis the exact same way every time. The breach of the mine wide obstacle, seize a foothold, start clearing. I'm sure that your subordinate commanders probably do it a few different ways, whether it's an area defense, perimeter defense, pulling them into the center. Could you give us a little vignettes of that?
Yeah, I definitely can. But just like you said, we see the same thing, the same mistakes over and over. And some of that goes into our planning cycle, the predictability of how a U.S. Army approaches this problem set.
Yeah.
And sort of that pattern recognition from seeing it over and over into the complex urban geometry that Regis is right there. And RTUs a lot of times lose the fight just because of their own complexity before they even get to our Black Horse troopers.
Yeah.
Some of that overstaffing, over-engineered plans, once the fighting starts, all that, you know, is good up until first contact, and that all goes out the window. The plans fracturing at first contact is what we count on from the RTU side, and we counter that through our junior leaders. Our junior leaders are enabled to make the decisions, shift to the enemy that they see in front of them, have multiple COAs that they can rapidly shift to and start looking for opportunities there that they don't have to ask for permission. They just execute, because especially in the urban fight, when you get into the fight and you hesitate, all that does is give the enemy opportunities to deplete you at that point in time. Same thing goes for sort of in the dead zone. Once we get outside of the urban side, is you hesitate in there, and you might as well go ahead and start the stopwatch there on about how much lifetime you have left before we can take advantage of it.
Yeah. And one of the things that I've seen evolve, and I'm, you know, if you tell me it's still there, but as we saw lessons from the early days of Ukraine, but also the urban warfare history of the actual way it went, it wasn't, of course, RTU was doing it the way the manual said, and probably the least cognitively overloading way to do it, rather than infiltrations and others, you know, doing the encirclement and the combined arms breach and secure foothold, start clearing. But the Black Horse started integrating those historical and modern urban warfare lessons. I think you mentioned at the beginning of the show, like strong pointing, rubbling and blocking the streets, rapidly placed obstacles to defeat observation, urban snipers, ambushes, all the historical things that you've seen in almost every urban battle that was almost defended, where the defender has had time. And maybe that gets to my question. One is that, do you still see all that, and how much time? And this is, I think, another myth of the Op 4 is that you don't get unlimited time to prepare for, just like, again, the planning cycle. It's an active free flow unit that gets a you give the order, I'm sure, at a certain date, and they have a certain amount of time to prepare the defenses of the city. So how much time do you usually give your subordinate commanders to defend the city? And then what kind of preparations do you see even of the last few rotations?
Yeah, sort of that gets to part of that, part of the myth, just like you talked, is that we're in there for weeks at a time defending and prepping it. The reality is, sort of going back to my opening comment, we're only about 40% the size. So when we're fighting the other part of the rotation, I don't have the spare forces to put back in the rear to continue those preparations at scale. We might have a few leaders back there that are doing some more TLPs, trying to work through where they want stuff to go. But in between that, our forces are up forward fighting because, you know, that first echelon force then becomes my second echelon force, which then becomes the third echelon force, which then becomes the urban defenders as the days roll on. It's the same people that are fighting day in and day out. Just that's the shell game we have to play to make sure we stimulate the entire rotational unit. So I don't have dedicated forces just to leave in Razish for all 10 of those days.
Yeah.
So once, you know, it's sort of once the RTU gets to a certain point and it reaches a trigger, we will occupy the city and then get into our defensive prep in earnest there with the engineers and everybody else starting to dig. So time-wise, you know, we might have 48 hours, which might be a little longer than some think. Sometimes as less as least as 12 hours.
Wow. That's amazing. Actually, I didn't even know that. What is the best opposing force defensive tactics that you've seen consistently defeat or stall RTU or rotating units?
A lot of times what we see in there where they do well is just if they stick to the characteristics of offense and defense, if they come in with audacity, you know, just working through those characteristics, concentration, you know, massing at one point. And then honestly, surprise, if you throw us off of our timeline, that creates a problem for us. And then just keeping that relentless tempo up, there's reasons that those are characteristics of the offense, which translate to breaching and getting into that urban offensive maneuvers that the rotation, you know, rotational unit has to do to be successful. Where I see some of that successful, that, you know, some of the best defenses there, the same way of breaching that unmanned contact zone or that dead zone, you have to be decisive getting in there. And key enablers that we've seen, simplicity again, the units that try to be as complicated as possible, don't assume risk in any areas, try to cover everything, they give up their ability to concentrate at that decisive point. And most of the time, if you can concentrate at that decisive point, you will overwhelm us every single time. We just don't see it happen that often.
A lot of questions, but you almost have to be there to see those repeated mistakes. Even in Razish, it has its own. Every city has its own context. Even Razish has natural terrain built into it. It's a nodal city with approaches, like you said, even the strong pointing within the city. And I know there is a sub-T environment, but I've always been kind of not critical, but skeptical on the, you know, it connects a few of the buildings. And then back when I would observe it, usually the rotating unit is so overwhelmed that the Black Horse doesn't really throw that at them that much, the sub-T environment.
And that's still an accurate statement. We very accurate.
Yeah, it's, I mean, because the underground, as somebody who's now been to Gaza 6-7 times, it's hard to comprehend when you have a sub-T environment possible every step you take. I know that's not true in Razish, but there are fake sub-T, then there are buildings that are connected in the sub-T, but usually in the past, even the commander operations groups like, no, we can't do that. It would be detrimental to the training to throw that level of complexity at them.
Right. We might be in Razish for the full 10 days.
Right.
Trying to root everybody out. But you bring up an interesting point. I don't know if you saw the reporting just this past week of the Ukraine conflict, and I believe it was specifically on the Russian side, starting to turn just a regular maneuver warfare in those strong points into a sub-T by connecting a lot of their trench systems underground, sort of Gaza style, which adds another complexity onto the regular battlefield outside of the urban areas, brings sort of the urban area into the large-scale combat area that you hadn't thought through before.
Absolutely. I mean, we can, all those episodes and all my trips into Ukraine, because initially, I mean, it was about defending certain urban terrain, and that was, but then it transitioned the sub-T, well, both the urban, right? You know, all roads lead to urban. While Rajesh, it is a culminating event. It isn't necessarily the primary objective, let's say, where in Ukraine, I mean, there is a lot of fighting that's gone on for years, but the decisive battles are over those urban terrain. You're right on the sub-T, and even in trench warfare, you cover a trench, it starts to become a subterranean environment. There's been, even to this day, still massive amounts of subterranean in the urban, even in the, on the way to the urban, like you said, in, even in the trench line fronts, mining, counter mining, all the things that we thought were gone, but also even infiltration through the subterranean, the gas pipes and multiple cities, sometimes successfully to infiltrate, others not successfully. It's definitely present when you really throw the complexity of the urban terrain, where I say all warfare is hard. The complexity of the urban terrain is a different level when, especially like you said, you start throwing all the electromagnetic spectrum sensors. And I know that Rajesh at times has really advanced that from the sensor networks to the emitters to all these different things that are a part of this. And I personally believe there should be an urban combat training center. And I know that I threw that at you openly. And as much as we came out of certain wars, understanding what we needed was a much larger training area to fully train our units, I believe that you truly need something bigger than Rajesh, because even within the NTC rotation, the amount of time that can be allowed, although, like I said, past commanders wanted to get to like 36-hour exercises there and just can't for many reasons. And I know of many of them that you just can't. You can't do brigade size operations for multiple days, although that's what it truly take, but that's not the training goal per se, because you're training a metal that's vast. But I believe we need an urban combat. And the only place you could do it for the US military would be at NTC. That's a totally different topic. Back to picking your brain. Do you have like a top five list of the most common mistakes you see? I know you mentioned a couple, but maybe within the attack of Rajesh that they make tactically. So of course the planning, and I know that a lot of it falls apart even at the breach site, but further on from that, like the top mistakes you see them if you observe them in that operation.
Yeah, some of it, like I said, is just the ones that try to overcomplicate it. Don't pay attention to the characteristics of the offense, like I talked before.
Yeah.
Spending what we're seeing now with the dead zone out there, spending more time in that unmanned contact zone, massing in that zone for a longer period of time. Data overload, you mentioned the cognitive overload.
Yeah.
We've watched that with some of the newer units that are, you know, trying to field a lot of new tech up front. It has been, you know, it gets to a point where there's too much, it slows you down. You combine that with the exposure that you have in that time in the dead zone, it just opens the opportunities for us in there. And failure to mass at decisive points, sort of a weak recon and security, not isolating objectives, allowing us to still maintain some interior lines so that I can, like I said, I don't have the ability to mass. I don't have the numbers. But if you allow me to assume risk and move my forces around at will, where we can mass, you know, our limited combat power at a point, I'll do that every time. And that's a lot of times how we win. I very rarely ever fight a brigade. I very rarely fight a battalion. But I try to isolate a battalion and then fight a platoon and a company at a time.
Yeah.
and I eventually will get through the entire brigade.
Love that. Love that. What about the sort of lethality? So I, you know, one of the, if you go back and listen, and this has now been, I don't know, probably 4 years since that podcast with the commander of operations group, but he talked about, I don't want to give it a name, but just say an assumption about the urban terrain, even fires, whether that's the use of smoke or all fires in the, in that urban terrain. Do you find it that despite a very, you know, of course, protection of civilians, understanding the constraint on the use of force, but do you find that the sometimes the rotating unit won't maximize their fires once they hit the urban terrain, unlike the open terrain, and stop your freedom of maneuver, even in inside the city, interior lines, with fires, even though they have those assets?
We have started this here recently. We have had units that have done very well at starting to sort of remove that risk, sort of remove that coin mentality.
Yeah. I didn't want to call it the coin hangover, but that's what it's called.
It's still coin hangover. Yeah. It's real. And having fought the coin fight here and then fought the decisive action now into the large-scale combat operations, I've been here and watched that whole evolution of it. And just recently, we have started having a mentality shift where units are starting to, you know, take that risk, take entire buildings down, and eliminate strong points that they have identified through their own ISR, doing nice. good work with their ISR, figuring out where our strong points are, and then just take the whole building down.
Love that. It was a big issue in the past, and if we can break that. Within understanding all the laws of armed conflict, the rules of engagement, but the true lethality of an urban battle, and if you have a strong point, which I've written about, is a very historically, and if you have sub-T under it, I mean, it's even worse, but once you go lethal, you're not clearing those buildings in four-man stacks. The tactic has less applicability. If you know that that's a strong point, why not use especially precision guided munitions?
100%. That is the way to clear an urban environment.
Absolutely. So that's refreshing. I mean, I hope you don't see everybody holding on to it, not even counterinsurgent, because that's not even the tactic. But the old way that I've seen so many units approach Rajesh is, again, breach, secure a foothold, start clearing. And by clearing, they're stacking on doors, and you have platoons and squads doing that when, you know, that's, you know, that is just not what is going to be at this, depending on the context that you're giving them, the urban fight, and especially an urban, a strong point, which will just turn into a, you know, whether it's, and I wrote this, a meat grinder for you, and you have fires, it's training those leaders, whether it's before, like you said, if they've done good ISR, reconnaissance, all this, but even in the operation, if you face a machine gun in a building, even our own history, even during the global war on terrorism, you don't keep trying to stack on a door or whatever it is. You use the assets you have available.
100%. And like I said, we've seen both, but it has been refreshing to see. We've seen a couple units do it so far where they have gone to that measured approach where, hey, I'm just going to take that entire building down. Why would I send a platoon in there to clear that strong point? I clear that strong point with a, you know, precision guided munition at distance, and I don't have to worry about it. So yeah. we've started to see that.
Great.
And also with that, we're starting to take advantage of that by not, you know, watching our own signatures, so you can identify where those strong points are, or pulling the unit into undefended areas, having them set up a strong point, and then we turn the same strategy around on them and we take the building down.
Love it. Even if you pre-rig it to blow, that's my friend Jason Giroux. I mean, it's happened in Ukraine. Of course, it happened in World War II, where you draw them into a building they think is clear and you've rigged it to blow and you're blowing on them. It happened in Bakhmut. It happens in urban warfare, actually in history, multiple times. It happened in Ortona, and now in Ukraine, that awareness of being able to fight in that concrete jungle and that threat being there. And if I'm the op four, of course, I would be a very mischievous, to all the urban warfare history I have, rigging buildings to blow and pulling them into those would be one of those. But Kevin, I know that I wanted to give you time to transition. That's amazing. So refreshing to hear. It's still the world's premier training exercise for urban warfare at the site there's very few rivals of it. I wish I have my wish list of what I would change, but I think that hopefully we have time to talk about that. You've written for the Modern War Institute, and you've now mentioned it a few times. I know it's definitely important to you about something bigger than Rajesh. And of course, you see the entire rotation, the entire training area. And as your duties and responsibilities, kind of as this opposing force commander, one of the world's premier, if not the world's premier unit, is studying the modern battlefield to make sure you replicate that. So we're training our units. And you've written about this dead zone and the empty battlefield. Could you tell us a little bit more about that? Of course, I highly recommend the article at the Modern War Institute called The Dead Zone and the Empty Battlefield. And what does it mean to you? How do you see it replicated? How are you ensuring that that reality that you've observed is being replicated there and what your forces are told to do?
Yeah, that's great. And like I said, especially the articles. Were really a team effort. It really is all of the Black Horse leaders, Josh Rada, a couple of the others that are authors on there, Gaston. Yeah. They were the ones that really have developed a lot of this concept. But really, the dead zones, that mutually contested sort of banded terrain, really 10 to 15 kilometers deep, even deeper now with more capability, the fiber optics, everything else. The further you can reach, the more deadly that zone gets on both sides of the front line of troops, where that sensors, the precision strike systems from both sides overlap. And anything that moves in there across that transparency, you know, it'll get seen and it'll get hit. And it's not just a no man's land anymore. It's more of a kill sack on both sides that extend all the way into your own rear areas. And the empty battlefield sort of builds on that old idea where modern lethality and sensors have forced everyone to disperse so much that the ground looks empty. Even when thousands are fighting, you just don't see the big formations in those zones anymore. Just small teams, drones, fires, precision strike, and ISR dominate that zone. And you have to understand that and adapt our doctrine, our formations to that. It's that changing geometry of the battlefield that has really extended a brigade's operational area, you know, 4-8 times of what it would be in a Cold War construct.
Of course, the dispersion, and I think you mentioned earlier about how you're replicating that. How do you, because I have this, my own thoughts about, you know, my trips to Ukraine and the evolutions of it from the Russians learning that mistake, the command centers, the signatures, all of that, adapting to that, you know, the EW fight. Dispersion is, of course, important, but then how do you translate that to the massing that is still, like you said, a principle that you need to mass and concentrate at the decisive point in the evolution of a rotation?
Sort of what we have demonstrated in the past few rotations. Nothing substitutes for distance, sort of like the old quantity has a quality all of its own. Well, mm-hmm. Distance has a quality all of its own on this new battlefield. And you just have to stay away from the majority of your enemy's strike capability. If you can push outside of their range rings, you increase your chance of survival, which is critical. You got to be alive to be able to fight, number one, but you have to be able to still conduct troop leading procedures. You still have to organize for combat. And then you have to project that combat power across this vast distance of a no man's land, you know, in order to concentrate at that one point, that one decisive point, because you still have to maneuver on the battlefield to win.
Yeah.
And that's the biggest change right there. Is the sheer distance that happens over now. We see it in the Russia-Ukraine side. And we're demonstrating it here. One rotation ago, we had an attack that was nonstop, 130 kilometers start to finish, is how far that we went in order to move all the way around and attack on a flank. And it was 24 hours of nonstop movement over that 130 kilometers across literally the entire box, sort of demonstrating that process, because you can stay outside of those range rings drop in your enemy's high payoff target list so that the assets that are back there are less important for the enemy to waste a low quantity, high precision, long range munition on a T-80 tank. No one's going to launch something on that. So that tank can stay deep and no one's going to strike it because they are looking for a higher payoff target to use that exquisite munition on. But it's the ability then to take those maneuver forces, organize them for combat, and then project it quickly across that dead zone. You know, you're still going to lose something, but if you're concentrated enough at the decisive point, those characteristics of the offense and defense still matter when you reach that point.
Yeah, it reminds me. So it's a side, but I just finished a book with Liam Collins, my partner in research, on the 2020 and 2023 Nagorno-Karabakh War, which was, for some reason, being talked about as that transparent battlefield, which it was in some ways, and in some ways it wasn't. And you still had a vast line of contact and dead zone to work through using very historical engineering, mobile protected firepower, penetration, what do you call it, stormtroop tactics. You still had all that. You still had to move. They moved over 130 kilometers on foot through severely restricted terrain in order to conduct a surprise attack while doing deception operations at a very high level, a core level, in order to keep assets focused on a different area. So I saw some of that even in the book that we're about to hopefully release. It's going through peer review. So it's an amazing article, Kevin, and the whole team, like you said, that wrote both those articles. And the other one, the reconnaissance strike battle in the Mojave Desert with the Centaur Squadron, prepares army units to win the first fight. I recommend that one as well. So I can't thank you enough. I love reminiscing about Rajesh and taking a different angle on it, on the aspects of defending it. Really appreciate your time.
No, and I appreciate your time and your interest and ability to see sort of the side that a lot of people don't look at, but it's really, really short of a treasure to see it from an enemy perspective. So most time we see it from our own perspective, even when we're sort of peer reviewing and conducting our own after action reviews, we rarely get the enemy perspective that we get to see rotation after rotation. So that's the greatest thing, is the battlefield's changed and our training environment has to change with it. And that's what we are doing here at the National Training Center.
Absolutely. And as an old, again, Geronimo, no offense, that's where I learned about warfighting, was actually being that opposing force, and especially about adaptability. Some of the greatest warfighters we have in our formation are the Op 4, because they're doing it, they're adapting, usually outnumbered, much like our concepts. And with all of this, better equipped, better that, but they're the best trained, motivated. I drank the Kool-Aid a long time ago and understand the resource that the United States military has committed to having these formations, which is, if you don't do a global kind of going out and visit all these militaries, like, who is your op for? It's like, well, it's the other unit or the other platoon that's not training right now. You don't get that mastery that our op for, and you repeat offenders clearly get it, and what a special treat that is. So when every rotating unit goes out, they're not being scripted against an easy fight. They're facing the hardest fight, hopefully, they'll ever fight.
That's correct, yeah, because the next fight's going to be violent, fast, and chaotic because of how we have changed, especially with Black Horse, changed the way we fight to match that current battlefield. Every BCT that comes through here gets that catalyst that is required for it to learn to win that first fight of the next war.
Absolutely. So, okay. So I did enough promoting of your Black Horse. Thanks so much. I hope to see you out in the desert sometime.
All right. You're welcome out here anytime. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Kevin. Thanks for listening to the Urban Warfare Project podcast. The podcast is produced by the Modern War Institute at West Point. What you hear in each episode are the views of their participants and do not represent the positions of West Point, the Army, or the U.S. government. You can subscribe to the Urban Warfare Project podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. And be sure to check out NDY's other podcasts, as well as the new articles we're publishing every day on our website. Thanks again for listening.